So, this is the last lecture you'll get from me. I have one more lecture from Matt Fusey. And I think what I'll do is I'll talk a bit about I'll elaborate on the stuff I said at the end of the last lecture. So there's how you put probabilities on top of a circuit. I want to say there's a lot of work that's been done in this sort of general area recently. So I'm going to talk about my own work. But there's a lot of stuff out there, and if you're interested in this, then depending on your taste, you may prefer some of the other approaches. So stuff that's very similar to the stuff that I've done is the Pavia crowd, right? Because they started in Pavia. So that's Giulio Chiribella, Mauro Dariano, and Paolo Perinotti. These two are still in Pavia. Giulio came here for a postdoc, and now he's in Beijing, I think, in China. There's the Oxford crowd. So there's Samson Abramsky. And Bob Kirker, who've been pursuing a sort of category theoretic approach to quantum theory, which really just means that they have they're using diagrams. There's a lot of diagrammatic analysis here, and there's work done by Liefer and Speckens. Which is sort of different. All these things are different in character, and they're adopting sort of thinking from the machine learning approach, adopting it to quantum theory. And then there's also interesting stuff that's been done recently by other people, more in this vein. So Matt Fusey has, for example, worked on this kind of approach. So there's a lot of stuff out there that's been done in the last decade or so. And of course, I'm just going to talk about my approach because I'm more familiar with that, although not as familiar as you would think. It turns out. So one question we can ask is what is an experiment? I spent a couple of years in experimental laboratories, working as a theorist, but assisting or trying to assist. And it's very interesting to do that, to look at, see what experiments really look like, because they're kind of messy and they're very removed from our normal, everyday, sort of clean, theoretical life. Those are the wires going everywhere, and it's just a big mess, really. And it's interesting to look at the kinds of problems they have to deal with. So I remember there's one problem we had, which was that the phase shifts in a particular quantum optical system weren't constant. I was in Rome, and they kept changing because the temperature in Rome changes a lot. It gets hot and cold during the course of a day, and the air conditioning wasn't working properly because this was Rome. So it was a problem, and so the way they solved this was by finding a metal, I think it's called Invar, so some sort of special alloy, which has a very low expansion coefficient, and then the phases stayed constant and so on. And it just struck me that that's very different from the way we think in theoretical physics. We don't normally put an air conditioning correction term to the Hamiltonian. And so on, although perhaps we should. So it's interesting to think about experiments. And of course, as theorists, we have to be a bit schematic, otherwise we wouldn't be able to cope. But these sort of experiments, what they seem to involve is, well, you have apparatuses. So this can be things like lenses, optical fibers, lasers, whatever, detectors. Since I'm a theorist, here's an apparatus. Actually, let's make it a bit more complicated. I'll draw it like that. And these boxes, they contain all the clever working of the device, but typically they may have some settings on it, so some sort of knobs that you adjust, and they may also have lights that flash, or more nowadays, of course, this is going to be wires that go to the computer to store the data, but they have sort of outcomes. And just represent that by a sort of a meter you can read off along a scale. So you have settings, and then you have outcomes. The boxes also have holes in them.
Is that so experimentalists can breathe?
Yeah. I think it's an uncomfortable life being an experimentalist sometimes. They have to, stay up while the experiment is running to make sure that Microsoft doesn't crash or something. So there's various holes in these boxes, and these are the apertures. So, in the case of a quantum optics experiment, you'd be sending photons into and out of these holes. To make the experiment work, well, they put a whole bunch of these boxes next to each other in certain ways. They line up the apertures. And there's a bit more to it than that. They have to gate the use of these boxes. So they have to say when you're interested in the setting and the outcome. So there's a lot of work that goes into setting up experimenting. Also, there's a lot of work in just lining up these apertures, getting the photons to go where you think they're going. So this is sort of, this is a rough depiction of what happened, the sort of things they have in the laboratory. Have you had a chance to visit IQC during this? You have. So you went into some, like, Kevin Resch's laboratory or something like that. So you've seen these kind of things going on. Good, good.
But it's just like that.
Yeah, it's pretty good sketch, really. Okay, so that's what experimentalists have to contend with. We want to turn this into something that theorists try to contend with. So we have an abstraction, which I'm going to call an operation. So this is an abstraction. And what we do is, well, we choose a particular setting that's taken to be implicit in this symbol A. And we also choose a particular outcome or set of outcomes, and that's also implicit in this choice of letter A. And then we have to do a bit more, that we say, we for these holes, or apertures, give them a nicer sounding name, we say what we're going to do with them. So we say, well, this hole, we're going to allow ourselves to send photons in here. And photons are going to represent by A. And those that's in. And this hole here, let's give it three holes at the top. This hole, we're going to have photons come out. This one we're going to send electrons into, and this hole we'll send whatever, some kind of particles, called particles of type C and particles of type D. So we've done quite a lot because with this box, you know, you can do anything with it you want. You could kick it, you could toss it in the air. Even if you could send small, you could fire small rocks into here and here. But we sort of don't expect the box to do anything very interesting unless we use it in the right way. And it's been built with a certain purpose in mind, which is to have these kinds of particles sent into it. So this is very much trying to make this operational way of thinking a bit more concrete. And in some ways, it's unsatisfactory because physics is meant to be a theory that tells you what happens in any situation. I mean, ultimately, physics should tell you what happens if you kick this thing or fire small rocks into it. However, this kind of operational formulation will only work when you're doing the right thing with these boxes. They've been built with a particular kind of purpose in mind. When people experimentalists build apparatuses, they're very careful that they build them with a particular purpose in mind, and they're meant to probe some sort of underlying reality with that particular purpose in mind. Okay, so we've abstracted. We've talked about this notion of an operation. We've described the use of this box by saying that it corresponds to sending certain input, certain types of systems in the holes and certain types of systems coming out. And we've selected a particular setting and a particular set of outcomes. And then the other thing we have to do is gate the use of this apparatus. So in real experiments, this is often done with sort of some sophisticated electronics that looks at the apparatus during the right time interval. So in general terms, we can say an operation corresponds to one use of an apparatus. In a certain prescribed way. Okay. Any questions on this? No. Actually, one small issue. I meant to use red chalk. Now we come to the notion of a circuit. So this is the idea where you wire together these operations. Some way. And even here, it's interesting to try and think a bit more about what this really means. Think of this as being like one of those diagrams you get when you buy a piece of furniture, sort of like IKEA furniture or something. they often get a diagram that shows you an exploded picture of the piece of furniture with little lines showing you how it connects together. Well, this is just like this. What this is saying is that the hole in box B here should be placed right next to the hole in box C here. And likewise, everywhere else. So here's an example. Imagine we had an experiment that looked like this. We have a laser. We have a lens. We have a detector. Okay, very simple experiment. Then in terms of operations, what we have is we have one operation for the laser. Then here we have an operation which is passage through air, through a block of air. Okay. Then we go into a lens. What to call that? Let's call it B. Then we have some more air, so different length of air. Let's call that C. And then finally, I ran out of space. We have the detector. Okay. Because the transformation that's enacted by this block of air is non-trivial. We can't just think of it as the identity. So we better treat it, we better give it its own box. And experimentalists spend a lot of time trying to make sure that the alignment is correct, so you go into this block of air and out of it in the right way. Sometimes they actually use optical fibers, and then it's easier. Okay. So if we have a circuit like this, we can. This is a sort of diagrammatic notation for the circuit. We can also write the same thing down symbolically, and I showed you how to do that last week. yesterday, rather. So every time, you know, we have a wire from box A to box B, it's a wire of type A. Sorry, it corresponds to a system of type A. So we just put a 1 there to indicate this wire, and so on. And we can, in this graph, we can distort it in any way we want, as long as we keep the wires connected to the boxes in the right places. It has the same meaning. And likewise, over here, we can write these big letters in a different order. We can also change the integers. Rather than writing a 1 here, we could write a 7. Doesn't really matter. It still has the same meaning, yes?
Are we sort of assuming that the box waits for both inputs such that there's no timing issues?
We're assuming. So I think actually, incidentally, this whole timing question, sort of understanding how to put timing, gating into this sort of notation, deserves more attention. And people in this community don't think about it enough. But so this, at this point, what I want to say is that we're using this box during a certain time interval. And it's supposed to have the right behavior during that time interval. And then this one, we're using it in the next corresponding time interval, and so on. So the machinery at the back that's doing the gating is telling you when to look at those boxes. And that's part of what you mean by the operation. That you do it, you use it at the right time.
Okay. Also, this is supposed to be for classical systems as well as quantum systems.
This should work. This is sort of a general theoretical framework. So. We're not committing to classical or quantum or any other kind of theory at this stage. Yeah.
What type of circuit would you use to describe, say, a gas diffusing in a box or something?
So one problem with this framework is that it seems to pertain to certain types of experiments. So So another classical experiment would be, you know, say a statics experiment. You have a ladder leaning against a wall. Well, that doesn't really involve the passage of systems between the different bodies, and it doesn't seem to be the most obvious framework there. I thought more generally about this kind of framework and how you might apply it to physics in general, and I have a paper on that I can point you to. So, say for example, the idea of a gas diffusing in a box. What you could try to do is, you could look at the gas, look at the box and the gas during different time intervals. And so you'd be gating that box over different time intervals. And you could look and see, and maybe you're making measurements during those different time intervals to see where the gas is. And so that would give you your operations, looking at the gas during the different time interval and gating. But there is a question of whether this circuit picture applies very well to physics in general. I think you can force it to apply to a lot of physics, but it's maybe not the most general framework. Just to elaborate on that, if you have the idea of some physics of a state evolving in time, then you can so you have some state, time, the state evolves in time, so you can sort of look at the state over different time at different points. And now you can regard this as corresponding to operations where your each of these boxes corresponds to a certain thing happening during that time interval and so on. So you can force this to work. Okay, so to set up this kind of framework, the first thing we do is make an assumption . We assume that the probability associated with a circuit is that it can be assigned and it depends only on the specification of the circuit. So each of these boxes has a set of outcomes associated with it. Mm-hmm. So the probability of the circuit is the joint probability that the outcome on each box is in the set associated with that operation. So remember over here when I defined the operation, I said it had an outcome associated with it that was implicit in the symbol A, big A. Okay. So maybe for this box, maybe this piece of apparatus has, maybe the piece of apparatus associated with this box has a red light on it that can flash or not flash. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the case where it flashes. And then likewise, we have some outcomes in each of these other boxes. So we're interested in the probability for the circuit in total.
So the circuit represents only a single measurement, not an
experiment? Yes, circuit represents a particular set of outcomes distributed across the experiment.
So if I'm taking the circuit model, mm-hmm. I might not care at all what happens to B, because I might say only be looking at the outcome of C and D.
Right.
So in that case, if I want to write down that circuit, do I get rid of B and just kind of incorporate it into, put it back into A, or do I just take a sum over all possible outcomes?
So what you're saying is you're not interested in the outcome on the box, on the apparatus. Corresponding to B. So then you'd have you'd put in here an operation. Let me call it I'm going to call it B prime, which and that operation corresponded to having the set of outcomes associated with that operation is the complete set of outcomes, is the full set of outcomes on the apparatus. So that means that whatever happens at this box, this box essentially always happens, that you always see the outcome in the set of outcomes associated with that box. So that's called a deterministic operation. And so you can do that in the boxes you're not interested in. But you still care about where the boxes are, because that would affect the probability of seeing what you see. Okay.
Sorry, another thing. If I'm just thinking about like photons and beam splitters,
mm-hmm.
if I put a beam splitter in B,
mm-hmm.
then depending on where it comes in A, I can get kind of a mixture like C and D. The C and D, like the particle outlets, can be entangled.
Mm-hmm.
How do I count?
That's fine. So these boxes are this stage. This is just a description of the experiment.
Right.
We're not saying anything about the states or what happens. Now it turns out that you can put some mathematics on top of this, which will accommodate the sorts of experiments you're talking about. Yeah. So this assumption, it's worth saying. It's reasonable. In a sense, that if your apparatuses are behaving properly and you set up the experiment well, then you'd hope that you'd have a well-defined probability associated with this. Now, you wouldn't expect to have a well-defined, or you wouldn't expect to be able to assign a probability to this apparatus. Because, so you want to say, you're asking what's the joint probability that the outcome here will be in the associated set, and the outcome here will be in the associated set. Well, that's going to depend on what is sent in here, and you haven't specified that. And so, whatever probability you write down here, somebody could mess with you by sending in something here that will mean that you're wrong. So. We can't really associate probabilities with fragments in general, although there may be particular situations where we can. It could be that inside this box, there's just a brick that absorbs that system. And so actually we can associate a probability with it. So that's the sort of calculation you want to be able to do with your framework to find out when you can assign probabilities and what they're equal to. But in general, you can't assign probabilities with these kinds of situations. Okay. let me. So once we got this, excuse me, some water. Once we've got this assumption, then we can start to do a lot, and we can build up the notion of states. So here's how that goes. I can use this. I think by the last day, I finally worked out the optimal way to get the blackboards where I want them.
That's okay, they'll change it.
Right, yeah, somebody will mess with the software. Okay, so I want to, so imagine I have some operation, like let's take a simple case. This is a preparation. So a preparation is an operation that only has outputs. A more complicated case may involve, more something like this, where I have a bigger thing. But let's just take a simple case. So this is a preparation. And I want to associate states with preparations. I could say the state is equal to the probability associated with this preparation. You'll see soon why it matters what color I use. Followed by something that closes that into a circuit. Where we just have a list over all possible, I call these results, over all possible things that close this into a circuit. Okay, well, we know we can assign these probabilities by this assumption. So now we just have a very, very, very long list over every possibility. The trouble with that is that it's a very long list. And it may be that there are actually relationships between these probabilities so that you don't have to specify the probability for every single way of closing this into a circuit, and that it's possible instead to give a smaller set. So the idea is that instead of having to choose all z, we can do it like this. We can choose a set of results, so a set of things that close this into a circuit, and then we will label them with some integer a, a1, up to ka. Okay. So I'm going to use white chalk to represent mathematical objects and red chalk to represent things in the laboratory. So here we have a set of results, but we're labeling them by this integer. And so now we want to represent the state like that, as a list of probabilities over a set of results. Now, as long as you choose a big enough list, this will work, because then any other probability can be calculated from the ones in this list. And we're going to assume that you can calculate any other probability in a linear fashion. So this is going to be such that, so we choose this, we choose a set of these, and it's just such that we can calculate this probability, the probability for any result that we use to close this into a circuit by a linear expression like this. And all I've done really here is all this big talk was the same. It's just the same as the P dot R I was talking about previously. Any questions on this? There you go.
Can you just say one more time, like, why do you have the B1 versus an A1 on the B, on the capital B?
Sorry, which one, where are we? Oh, that's a mistake. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's a mistake. So this corresponds to the circuit, this corresponds to this. Yeah, so the expression I wrote down was badly typed. This is correctly typed, it has to close. It has to, you know, always the same integer has to correspond to the same letter. Otherwise you're trying.
When you write prob of and then you do a circuit, you're talking about the joint probability of all the outcomes on all the different.
That's right. So the joint probability that the outcome that happens on this piece of apparatus is in the set of outcomes associated with operation A. And at the same time, or jointly with the outcome over here being in the set associated with the outcome B, with the operation B.
Do you mean the probability that the outcome of A is in the set of outcomes of A, or rather the probability of where it is in the set of outcomes?
No, I just mean, imagine the piece of apparatus. So maybe I'll use a different color of chalk to represent the actual experiment. Oh, it's a different symbol. So this is the box. And furthermore, I've specified over here, with this operation, there's a whole set of different outcomes represented by dots. Okay, so here's four possible outcomes. But for the operation A, I'm only allowing the outcome to be, say, in one of these two.
Okay.
And likewise, over here, the outcome, there's a whole set of possible outcomes. This could be different lights that might flash. And for B, it's got to be in one of these. So I want to know here, this probability is the probability that the light that flashes is in this set, and the light that flashes over here is in this set. So in the simplest case is where you're just considering one light flashing. But it's nice to be a bit more general to allow some kind of coarse graining.
So BA morning red is the same kind of object as ZA, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
What's XA?
XA1 is, because it's labeled, I've got it's a particular choice. I call it a fiducial set of results. It's a set of results. Let me just be clear what I mean by results. So this is a preparation. And then you need a name for this kind of thing. So I'm going to call that. So I call that a result. So we have a set of results, because it's labeled by this. And it's a fiducial set of results because it's sufficient to determine an object A that we can use to calculate probabilities for any result. So in the case of quantum theory, if you have a spin half particle, this could correspond to measurements along the z plus, z minus, x plus, and x minus directions. So this would be where
I guess the thing I'm trying to get my head around is why you put two A1 indices.
Is that just like one in white, one in red?
Yeah.
You mean the two colors or the?
Yeah, like I'm trying to get my head around why you just.
So this one corresponds to the type of particle you're going to send into that, or come out of that hole and goes into that hole. So this is whereas this one is an integer. But it's good to use the same letter because it means that you can convert probabilities like this into mathematical expressions like this.
So A red, A1 red, X red, A1 red is the process of A emitting a particle A1, X receiving A1, or like the box receiving A1,
yeah,
and measuring X.
That's right, measuring, then the outcome is in the set associated with X. But then I have a, I'm going to use white chalk here. Then I have a set of outcomes associated with, I have a set of fiducial, I have a set of these kind of boxes, and they're labeled with this integer A. I mean, the point of all this is that we're showing how to maintain the same notation for the description of the circuit as we use for the calculation of the probability for that circuit. That's what all this achieves. So I've just given it you. I've shown how this works in the very simplest case, but you can do this in any case. So any circuit, like the one I drew up there, the the probability associated with this circuit can be given by an expression like this. These objects are tensors. And this is as long as you assume local tomography. Tomographic locality. So I haven't shown you why this is true, but it's not very difficult. Once you've seen this, then it's not very difficult to show that actually it works in this more general case.
That's under the assumption. I mean, local tomography is basically saying that...
Sorry, again?
Local tomography is basically saying that your measurement of D doesn't affect what happens between A sending particle A and B. So
local tomography is the assumption that you can characterize a multipartite state, so a box like this, it's the assumption that you can write down the state, you can characterize the state of this by making just measurements on these wires separately. You have to do different measurements, and so the measurements you end up making are a fiducial set over here. And a fiducial set over here. Okay, so you make if you make fiducial measurements over here and here, this the probability of this is equal something like this. So this is the set of numbers, the set of joint probabilities you get by making fiducial measurements on each of the two outputs. And the assumption of local tomography is that this is sufficient to fully characterize this box from a probabilistic point of view. So this is the state of that box. There you go.
Could you define what B with the white capital B with the lower indexes?
So the claim was that we can choose a set of fiducial results, which is big enough that we can just calculate any probability from this list of probabilities for any measurement, any final result, by a linear expression.
And lower index.
And so that's just this linear function. So this now gives you the linear function of this. that you can calculate this probability. So it follows, if we assume the claim is correct, that we can do this, then it's just there has to exist some linear function on these probabilities in here, so that we can calculate the probability for any B. And then this is just the way of writing that.
Oh.
Yeah. And this assumption of linearity, incidentally, is not trivial. But you can show that it follows if you allow arbitrary mixing of preparations. Then it follows that you have to make the thing linear. So in the context of probability theories, it's very natural to have this linearity. Okay, so I've tried to give you a taste of how this kind of thing works. You can do a lot more. In the case of quantum theory, you can... In the case of quantum theory, you can actually associate with each of these operations, you can associate operators, so objects that act on an appropriately defined Hilbert space. And so then instead, probability is given by an expression that just has hats on. And this turns out to be equivalent to standard quantum theory. And this is a more natural way of doing quantum theory, because then you can impose constraints on these operators in a very simple way that correspond to what's allowed, what the allowed operators are. So just as in with density matrices, you have to impose the constraint that they're positive and have normalization less than or equal to 1. Likewise, you can impose some very simply specified constraints on these operators, and you get quantum theory. So I haven't explained how this works, but it's fairly straightforward to set that up. Okay, so I have a few minutes left. So one question is, what's the point of doing all this? What's the point of quantum foundations, even? Well, there's different possible answers. Obviously, it's interesting to think about these sort of ontological questions. It's interesting to try and find better structures for formulating quantum theory. But I think there are possible payoffs. So one payoff that I think has happened is there's been a lot of applications in the field of quantum information that have followed from these kinds of conceptual thinking. And really, it's been a kind of symbiotic relationship. That's my attempt to represent a symbiotic relationship. Over here, we're asking fundamental questions. Over here, people are often asking very practical questions. And yet, there seems to have been a lot of payoff that thinking about these very fundamental questions has helped clarify how to do things, how to do more practical things. I mean, when I say practical, I still mean a theorist's version of practical. And thinking about quantum information has shone a lot of light on quantum foundations. So here's a few examples of things going in this way. So David Deutsch, who really laid the foundations of quantum computing, was motivated by many worlds. Those of you who have read any of his any of his popular writings will know that he's a very strong advocate of the many worlds approach. And this made him think that that you could have in parallel processing. So that you might expect to see some advantage in the context of doing quantum computations over classical. And even if you don't agree with the idea that the reason the quantum computers go faster is because of the Manuel's interpretation, it's still a fact that David Deutsch was motivated by this way of thinking, and it led him to develop quantum computing. Another example is communication complexity. So Richard Cleave, who is now here at IQC, was motivated by Bell's theorem, in particular by the GHZ version of it, which involves three particles, to develop quantum communication complexity reduction. So the idea there is that you have two people, and they each have, so you know, three people actually in this case, because it's GHZ, Alice, Bob, and Carol, I guess. They each have some information themselves, so X1, X2, and X3. And they want to calculate some function of those three variables. So in order to calculate that function, they're going to have to communicate with each other. And the question is, what's the minimal amount of communication they have to engage in order to calculate the function? Now, it turns out that if you have previously shared quantum states, or quantum entanglement shared between the three parties, then you can do that sort of thing with less communication than if you only had previously shared classical information. And the way this works is exactly that it uses the GHZ proof of non-locality, a particular version of non-locality. More recently, Bell's theorem has been used to show that you can do quantum cryptography in a way which is device independent. So you know, people who study cryptography are very mistrustful folk. They don't really trust anybody, and if they don't trust in particular the people who give them the apparatuses they use to do their cryptography, so there's the question: well, can you still believe in your cryptography even if you don't trust the people who sell you the apparatuses that you use to implement the cryptography? And it turns out, using quantum theory, you can do that. And that, again, that relies exactly on Bell's theorem. So that's the one direction, sort of the quantum theory applying to fundamental physics. I think what's more interesting is the other direction, is that using the sort of tools and techniques developed in quantum foundations to try to study even more fundamental physics. After all, if you're interested in fundamental physics, then what you really want is to see progress in fundamental physics. And my biggest hope in this direction is that some of the techniques that have been developed in quantum foundations will be useful to the problem of quantum gravity. In my own research, I've been developing this sort of general probabilistic framework in a way that might be suitable to the problem of quantum gravity. So you can see already here, this kind of circuit framework doesn't really look like it's going to work in the context of quantum gravity, because in quantum gravity, you expect to have something like an indefinite or a superposition of different causal structures, whereas this circuit framework has causal structure built into it, that you have the wires going along. The boxes are connected together in definite ways by the wires. But still, one can still think in these very general terms, and perhaps perhaps this is a good approach to the problem of quantum gravity. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you.